and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule to be with us tonight. Tonight I have with us Dr. Michael Stone, and we're going to talk about detoxification issues and genetic snippets, among other things, nutrition, other things that we can do. Welcome, Dr. Stone, and thank you for taking time to your schedule to be with us.
Well, thank you very much. I'm excited to be here, and welcome to the audience.
Thank you. So before we get started, why don't you just tell us a little bit about you, and let me just say this. Even though Dr. Stone is a medical doctor, he is not, neither of us, obviously, are attempting to treat or diagnose you. This information that you hear on this show is for that reason only, for informational purposes. Please take anything that you hear on this show and discuss it with your own personal doctor. Okay, sorry. Just want to get that out of the way. So tell us a little bit about you and where people can find you and what it is that you do.
Sure. Well, I have the great fortune to practice in Ashland, Oregon, a family practitioner who practices with Dr. Leslie Stone and Dr. David Jones. We have a very full spectrum family practice that goes from preconception all the way up until the elder years. We also have the benefit of having two nutritionists that work with us in our clinic, and we use food as medicine and recognize using the functional medicine model that everyone is unique as their fingerprint. And so we try to take the history and everything that the patient has had in their life beforehand and then weave it into ways to help restore health and diminish some of the problems of chronic illness or chronic imbalance.
Do you have a website, or where can people find you?
Sure. We have a clinic has a website, ashlandmd.com, and one of the other passions in our practice is try to grow healthy babies. So you can also go to growbabyhealth.com and get all sorts of great information about how you use nutrition functionally to improve your health and generational health of your offspring.
Now, I'm curious, does insurance pay for anything that you do?
Yes, it does. You know, we're actually a insurance-based clinic. So we have, in the state of Oregon, we have Oregon Health Plan or Care Oregon. We take Medicare, and we really, functional medicine is a way of thinking. And so we are successful in using the insurance-based model and offering a functional medicine and functional nutrition approach to health.
So, and I wasn't planning on asking these questions, but now that it's been raised, I just kind of have to. Does insurance in any way cover any kind of early detection or prevention, preventional health care, or is it all once you get sick?
No, they do. And through the Affordable Care Act, there's more coverage for preventative medicine interventions. And so there is coverage for physicals and group medical visits where you can incorporate the use of nutrition and nutritionists in the education process to help ameliorate inflammation and bring balance back to the system. So it really does provide a model, and it's getting closer to being able to provide more healthful health care into the future.
Well, what a lucky population you have that lives around you to have you available, you and your clinic available. Do you do anything? Does any of your people in your practice do any kind of telephone counseling for people? Like if somebody, one of the listeners, wanted some kind of help and they live far away, is there any way you'd do that?
We do that. That's a little bit outside the insurance model, but yes, we do have Skype appointments and that kind of thing for information and try to help people get a place to start and information to take their provider. And we do that.
Wonderful. Okay. So now we'll get started into the interview. Actually, where do you want to start? I know that we had planned on talking about detoxification, but it's such a broad spectrum. Do you have a place that you like to start, or would you like it if I just start asking you questions?
Well, it's got a little bit dealer's choice. If you're a little bit not sure where to start, then I would start as I do with the patient. And we actually start when they walk into the clinic and trying to look for patterns of where they might have detox issues. So we frequently, you know, it's interesting. You can even start with height, weight, and waist circumference and hip circumference and how people hold on to their body weight and their body fat. And so if somebody is wider around the waist and narrower in the hips and their ratio is greater than 0.9 if they're males and 0.8 if they're females, then we really start thinking about a more pro-inflammatory or an immune imbalance condition that you have to consider how you're going to intervene and try to uncover what is driving the intoxication issues with the patient. So
I have a question here, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I think about that sometimes when I see people walking around, you know, in a store, a business or something, and they have these huge fat pads sitting on their hips. Is it, where do you go with that first way? Do you think that it's possibly metals too, or is it just fat? I've always wondered about that.
No, you're exactly right. And it's more than skin deep. And so if their waist is bigger than their waist ratio is bigger than their hip, then we think about inflammation, insulin resistance, and problems with blood sugar. If their hips are bigger than their waist, then we start looking a little deeper. We start looking into whether there are problems with hormone balance from their pituitary through their thyroid down to their adrenal control. We think and start thinking about whether there are food intolerances, whether they have a leaky gut or increased gut permeability and their immune system is cranked up. We think about if it's associated with fatigue on their questionnaires, then we really do start thinking about how are their mitochondria working and what are the heavy metals or toxins that might be blocking mitochondrial function. It's really looking at a functional approach to their underlying problem.
What about sometimes, well, I had this experience. I went from being like a pencil to, you know, doing the typical thing that people do who are toxic with heavy metal, having the hip thing. But I also had a big fat pad in between my shoulders, and much of that's gone away after I did metal detoxing. But why does it store in between your shoulder blades? What place is it right there?
You know, it is interesting. That's one of the fat pads is associated with adrenal issues, especially when you have chronic stress and you have increased cortisol release and production. You know, think of what happens when somebody the corollary is when somebody is put on steroids for a long time, what happens? Their face gets a little puffier. They start gaining weight. They start developing a little bit of edema. It starts affecting the sodium potassium balance. It starts affecting blood sugar. So they start gaining more weight because higher blood sugar, your insulin is triggered. And so you start laying down more fat. And then you start seeing with a chronically elevated cortisol, either from stress or from medication, chronic stress or medication, then you start developing the buffalo hump. So that buffalo hump will go away as your cortisol improves and as your balance improves and as your adrenal balance comes back into more normal and healthy levels.
Well, nobody that I've ever asked has known the answer to that question. Thank you. So you also brought up the potassium issue there, and we talked about that this afternoon. And then I'm going to give it back to you and let you go where you want to go. But now that you brought it up, I'm curious. What does that do to make, how does that make potassium get off? Because many people don't realize that they're potassium deficient.
You know, it's interesting when you look at the electrolytes in the blood test in the serum. Your body will do almost everything it can to maintain the acid-base balance in the blood. And so it does that by adapting to the glucose, adapting to the potassium, adapting to the sodium, adapting to chloride. And And if you start, it will harvest potassium or sodium, calcium. It will very actively try to maintain good serum levels. So what happens is you will start seeing some of the other changes that occur in the tissues outside the normal blood test. For example, another great example is magnesium, where we know that you can be phenomenally magnesium low and still have a low normal, I should say magnesium deficient, and still have a low normal serum level of magnesium. And that's partly because of the effect of parathyroid hormone and trying to maintain the magnesium level. So I would just say that you have to look beyond the normal serum levels in their ranges and put it in the context of the patient's story, the company of the other symptoms. So if you have somebody who has a normal potassium level, they have slightly higher or chronic stress, and they're starting to get a little more edematous in the lower extremities, they're starting to have increased fatigue, you start seeing a little more hippus, that rhythmic contraction of the pupil when you shine a light in it that doesn't seem to settle, then you start having to think about adrenal insufficiency or adrenal or the effects of the chronic stress of their lifestyle or the demands on their system. And so though you may have a low normal potassium level, if you have the company it keeps, the increased edema, increased fatigue, more muscle cramping, decreased exercise tolerance, you really have to then jump to the diet and see, do they have adequacy of potassium in their diet? Are they eating any greens, or are they taking any medications that are speeding, or any does their lifestyle speed the clearance of potassium, either through loss in their intestine or through loss in their kidneys? And so I would say that we look, from a functional medicine standpoint, you look beyond the normal lab values, and you really look at the company it keeps in the context that you see those values in, to put it in the patient's story and timeline of their health or their gradual disease.
I could go off here and ask you, finish the interview asking questions about that, but I'm going to resist because I know you have a lot of things to say, but that means you have to come back sometime and let me ask you questions.
Oh, sure.
So go ahead and go down your normal routine of educating people, and I'll try to stop interrupting.
Well, you can interrupt any time.
Thank you.
So when the, you know, it's kind of the workup of the toxic patient. So you have to look at, if you think you're toxic, what toxic, what are the toxins that might be involved? And so toxins basically trigger imbalances, true? So you can have exotoxins, things that come from the outside. Those are the heavy metals, and the most common in our environment are the heavy metals of cadmium and arsenic and lead and mercury. So think those are all cations that will compete with other cations in the similar periodic table, column. And so you have to think about heavy metals, and those heavy metals can be by things that we put in ourselves. Mercury, if you wish, things we eat, the cadmium in seafood on the West Coast, or mercury on the East Coast in the Atlantic. It can be arsenic from our wells. 20% of the wells in the United States have higher levels of arsenic. And so those are heavy metals you think about. You think about persistent organic pollutants. You think about organic chloride pesticides, so the food that you eat. You think of PCBs, and you think of mycotoxins. And then what do you do with those? I mean, if you have those, which all of us are exposed to, we're supposed to be able to get them out of ourselves.
Okay. So what about, sorry, I was focused on what you were saying, sorry. What about aluminum? Does it fall in there, or is it something different, a separate category?
No, that's exactly true. That's in the same category. And
okay.
So that is another thing that we get a lot in our environment via especially cookware. and also through some of the body products.
Now that you brought that cookware thing up, what cookware do you recommend? I struggle. I look and look and shop and rebuy and shop. What do you use?
Something with stainless steel and or glass.
What does it matter? What kind, like Revere with the cheap ones? Is that okay, or do you prefer something one of the better brands?
That is a good question, and I think it's all about control. Part of it is about control of heat, and also reassurance of what. If you're pretty reassured by the maker that they don't have a lot of other alloys involved, and so with the control of heat, the reason that's important is because you want to be able to control the heat so you don't have increased free radicalization of your oils and fats when you cook them too high or too fast. And so it's been kind of a gradual thing. I said the other thing that we still use some is we use iron cookware, and we found that very successful for people that have trouble getting enough iron in their diet. You can actually, if you simmer an acid-based, an acid food, think tomato sauce, tomato-based foods, you can increase by many fold the amount of iron, elemental iron that's in the food without having to take a pill as a supplement.
So I had stashed away all of my cast iron skillets because I thought they were bad for me. But I don't know. I was just doing it, guessing. You don't have an objection to using cast iron cookware?
No, I really don't, especially in some of our patients that they have trouble getting enough iron. We will just incorporate a couple times a week, simmering the tomato-based or acid-based foods, and you'll increase the amount of iron in that food.
Well, I'm glad to know I can reuse my cookware then, because I'd put it all away. Okay, so if somebody has those fat pads, let's just start there that we talked about earlier. We've already talked about why they get there. What would you do?
Well, the first thing is to think about, evaluate their lifestyle. So look at their sleep, look at their exercise, look at what foods they're having, look at their relationships. Are they in really stressful relationships with work, with their marriage or personal relationships? We know that sleep apnea or altered sleep or inadequate sleep, interrupted sleep, increases your cortisol levels. Okay, so it puts increased fatigue on your adrenals.
So let's start with the first one. I have to be careful here and not get off in the weeds. Let's say the person, because we know we're talking about the MTHFR and their accompanying mutations. That's what we talked about earlier. So I know that's kind of where we are. Let's assume that they're not getting sleep, and that their liver's not cleaning right, so they're not making hormones properly, and they don't have enough melatonin. How do you get them sleeping again safely without, increasing lymphocytes? What do you do?
Sure. So what we first do initially is we'll sleep log and see where they're interrupted. We'll figure out if they have any apnea. Because the apnea we're going to have to address, because that's a stress-inducing event. If they're not, then you start thinking about, can you make enough melatonin? Do you have enough protein in your diet that has a precursor tyrosine? So if the person has predominantly carbohydrate in their diet and they don't have enough protein, then they may not have the base amino acids to help them make the melatonin. The other thing is we recognize that light is a toxin. So we want the light and no light in the room. And no electronics in the sleeping area from about 11 p.m. to at least 4 a.m. If they're not a night shift person, to really not interrupt the normal sleep and production of melatonin. Secondly, if we think that they have issues with making enough serotonin, everyone's familiar with eating. Most people are familiar with eating white turkey, meat, high in tryptophan, and Thanksgiving, and pretty soon they, people are wanting to take a nap. Tryptophan is converted to 5-hydroxytryptophan, which is a precursor for serotonin, and serotonin levels have to be adequate to really initiate and help maintain sleep. And so we will talk about high tryptophan or high serotonin foods, and then we will go and make sure that they have enough of the precursor proteins in those foods, and then we will may initiate that. The other thing that we'll do is sometimes use some of the other herbal options that play a role. Think valerian. The other thing we do is for serotonin production, you have to have adequacy of magnesium. You also have to have adequacy of a few steps related farther away. You have to have adequacy of your methylfolate, your activated folate, one of the B vitamins. So we look at, in all people in our clinic and in every condition, we kind of look at six main categories. We look at adequacy of protein, adequacy of essential fats, not too much simple carbohydrates, so adequacy of fiber to help bind toxins out through the bowel, adequacy of the minerals, adequacy of the fat and water-soluble vitamins, and adequacy of the phytonutrients. So that's PFC-MVP, protein, fats, carbohydrates, minerals, vitamins, and phytonutrients. So we start there.
And if they had the sleep apnea, what would you do?
Sleep apnea, then we have we do evaluations, a couple tests. First of all, is the sleep apnea peripheral, or is it from too much tissue, soft tissue that is lax, so, or is it central? And so with the sleep apnea, one of the first things we do is if they're able to do it through insurance, we'll actually get a formal sleep apnea test. From that, we'll see the degree of desaturation. Sometimes if they can't afford that, then we're able to do an at-home oxygen saturation monitor just to see how low the oxygen saturation goes. You know, if your oxygen saturation drops to the low 80s, multiple times a night, and you are up above 16,000 feet, up toward 20,000 feet, and that is stressful. And if you are dropping that low 10, 20, 30 times a night, then that is a stressor on your adrenals. You'll have higher cortisol levels, and you actually have more trouble getting rid of your carbon dioxide and your nitric oxide. So we'll first do the normal testing or evaluate that, and then we will go about the business of looking at root cause. So is the root cause because of habits? Do you have more sleep apnea because of alcohol consumption? Are you taking medications that actually are too respiratory depressant? Or has the weight gain led to the fact that you're that you have more soft tissue and so you're more sleep apneic? If it is a weight-associated, cortisol-associated issue, sometimes we will use patients will have to use the CPAP machine until they get about the business of losing weight, changing body trans composition, and then frequently, if it's a non-central sleep apnea, people actually do well and can get off their machine.
And what's the other? What would you do for the other kind?
For the central?
I didn't realize there were different kinds until you started talking about it. So I guess I don't even know what that is. What would central be?
Well, that's one that's really triggered from the lack of triggering within the central nervous system to take a breath. And interesting is frequently people, once you get restoration of adrenal function, you get change in insulin resistance and you get change in body composition, the evaluation of the sleep apnea gives you different directions to go. So it's interesting that about 60% of people who have a BMI that's greater than 30 will have significant sleep apnea. So once again, when you look at somebody who's overweight or has had a lot of weight gain, you have to look at root cause and think that's driving that.
Okay. So the next step after you pass the sleep, well, I just want to let you know where I'm thinking.
Yeah.
I want to spend till about 20 till on detoxification. I'll let you go wherever you want to go next. And then I want you to spend the last, we stop at about 5 till, so spend the last 10 or 15 minutes talking about the prenatal.
Sure.
For the babies, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay, so what would be the next thing that you do? Or what? Or would you go to liver, or where would you go next?
Well, you know, once you identify what you think from their history, whether it's heavy metals or persistent organic pollutants or organophosphates or organochlorine, pesticides, or even mycotoxins, then it's ways to try to figure out how to evaluate the person's liver's ability to get rid of these toxins. So, you know, to do that, the first thing we do is we try to maximize or up-ramp their phase one and phase two detoxification. And so then it's using our nutrition, the nutritionist that's working with us, and we go right to diet. We try to figure out how we're going to, can we maximize their antioxidants, minerals, vitamins, amino acids, essential fats. Do they need to have a food, medical food, or a coffee smoothie that allows them to increase their sulfur if they can tolerate it to help and alkalinize their diet, meaning markedly increase the greens to try to aid with the kidney elimination of these. So we try to identify the toxins wherever they are. We remove those. If the toxin's food, we remove foods they're reacting to. If the toxin's heavy metals, we make sure that by looking at their urine heavy metal levels before they start any program, make sure they're not getting some in their environment, their job, or their things that they're taking by mouth. Then we try to help them excrete it. And so sometimes if we think it's a heavy metal, we'll go ahead and do a provoked heavy metal test, utilizing an aura chelator, and then we will see which metals are there. So frequently we see lead and mercury. Frequently we see arsenic. And depending on where those are, high arsenic levels, we actually will have them evaluate their water. We have them remove things that are environmentally or high, foodstuffs that are normally high in arsenic, and that can be the skin of some of the large farm chicken because of the food that the chickens eat. It can be the shellfish, depending on where those shellfish were collected. So it can be in crabs, it can be in scallops. And so we try to remove the source, and then we will help them bind it with and get rid of it through the use of some type of competitor to those heavy metals to help them clear it out. So that's what we initially do. Part of the physical exam, we look for the other aspects of that. So we'll look for rashes. We'll look for different nail findings. We will really try to evaluate the other associated symptoms that are associated with high lead, whether that's looking at their blood pressure, looking at their pulse rate, looking at whether they have any type of arrhythmia, to see if they have any of the other physical exam findings that go along with their story.
So you mentioned, I forget, something about the nails. What does that tell you? Because that's something easy people can look at is their nails.
Sure. So when you look at your nails, when you first look at them, you first see, is there any inflammation around any of the nail itself? So are your fingertips warm? If your fingertips are not warm, if you touch your face or you touch your upper chest and your hands feel cold, then you have to think about, do I have enough? What can be clamping my circulation down in my hands? Is it because I have circulatory problems, or do I not have enough protein amino acids that help those small blood vessels dilate? So sometimes people who have been told they have Raynaud's Raynaud's syndrome, known as an autoimmune symptom. Sometimes some of those folks are actually really low in protein and arginine, and arginine helps you make nitric oxide, and you'll get your really small blood vessels to dilate. If you look
big question there. For people who have herpes virus, what on earth do they do about taking arginine?
Usually they have to up their lysine.
Oh, okay. So you do it's okay to do it as long as you give it the antagonist with it?
Yeah, and then I also, that's very true. And then I also think what else in their system doesn't allow them to fight virus as well, right? So
okay,
your viral fighting nutrients will include, do they have adequacy of zinc? Do they have adequacy of vitamin A? Do they have adequacy of vitamin D?
What form of vitamin A do you like to use?
Well, it's kind of interesting. That's a good question, because most people think, well, beta carotene is adequate enough because your body will convert it to vitamin A, to retinol. What's interesting about that, however, is your body will have a hard time converting that if you're one of the 25% of people who really have trouble who have a SNP for beta carotene monooxygenase. So some people eat a lot of beta carotene rich foods, and their vitamin A level is still low. And so those folks actually need to take vitamin A, and they can take it in the liquid or the lyophilized form. The other thing to note is your liver stores a lot of vitamin A, but it needs to have zinc to adequately get that vitamin A out of the liver and into the bloodstream. You also have to have adequate retinol binding protein to help move it. So sometimes if people have trouble with vitamin A, sometimes you have to give the active form, counting on that their pancreas is secreting enough lipases to help you absorb your fat-soluble vitamins, that you can absorb it well. And then you go back and you look at the diet and you look at the patient and you think, okay, do you have enough zinc? Do you have enough protein to help move and transport and mobilize your vitamin A? So a short answer to your question is we will use a vitamin A drop as a bridge while we're trying to ferret out whether the person has trouble converting beta carotene to their vitamin A. And at the same time, we'll make sure that they have adequacy of zinc.
So
one of the interesting things about zinc is for every liter of stool, every liter of diarrhea, you will lose up to 10 milligrams of zinc. So think of how many people that you come across that have really loose stool. And then if you look at their nails, they may see little white spots on more than just their dominant hand. But they may see white these little areas of leukonychia, little white nicks, spots on their fingernails and toenails. And that can be markedly associated with zinc insufficiency.
You have such great information. I get carried off every time you say something new. Exactly what form of A, just so we're clear? Because there are several.
Right. So in our clinic, we frequently carry just a retinol drop.
Okay. All right. So, and go ahead to your next stage. I don't mean to interrupt you. It's just thought provoking. Sorry.
No, that's really fine. So then you think of what are the conditions that the patient has. So you can have toxicity issues that cause ADD, allergies, Alzheimer's, anemia, autoimmune disease, fibromyalgia. You know, you start looking through the disease toxins associations, and if you have somebody with cancer, you have to immediately think, what is the toxicity? What is the toxicity that led to the immune imbalance? What is the toxicity that when washed over their genes, they cannot get rid of? So if people have numbness or tingling in their feet, what is the toxicity that's leading to the neuropathy? Is it heavy metals? Is it glucose? Is it mycotoxins? If they have osteoporosis, is it lead? Is it cadmium? So So really, you have to have an eye, and no matter what the condition, you have to have an eye to consider looking for other toxicity signs. And then I usually ask about food, because so many people, even though only about 6% of people have the classic immune globulin E reactions to food, so they're classically allergic. Depending on the population, anywhere between 60 and 75% of people say they react to food. So what are they reacting to? Are they reacting to basic contents? Are they reacting to the natural processes, so fungus in the food? Are they reacting to the pesticide? You know, we have patients that can tolerate apples that have not been sprayed, but they have very significant, what they thought were allergic reactions to apples that have been sprayed. So apples that have a number of 4 as the lead number in the vegetable section. So, you know, what are the fungicides or pesticides that are with their food? What are the heavy metals or things that happen with spoilage? What are the canning, freezing products? So we really take a careful history, and this is where the nutritionist really helps us out. When we think somebody is toxic or having food reactions, we're wanting to know whether the food is causing an immune imbalance in their bowel, an increased permeability of their gut that's turning on their immune system, or is there something that is actually a food component like a lectin, gluten or gliadin, that is triggering a systems-wide response that people often can't identify until they are asked and helped to begin to understand all their issues. So we think about where the toxins come in. Did they ingest it? Did they breathe it? Did they smell it? Heavy metals go retrograde up your first cranial nerve into your brain. So that's an interesting issue when it comes to high lead levels or high mercury levels, or high cadmium levels from industry. It's also absorbed through the skin. So it's also transmitted vertically from mother to fetus to infant. Or you get toxins when there's penetration. Think penetration from insects, penetration from injections, dentistry, surgical. So, you know, taking a careful history when you think somebody's toxic, usually your initial question can be, when did you last feel well? And most people can identify exactly, if they're sick, they can identify exactly when they last felt well.
Interesting. I lost my train of thought. I was so focused on what you were saying. What about, a lot of people talk about when we're doing detoxification, many, many people go straight to liver, which is what I've done twice. But what about kidneys? How do you nurture your kidneys?
Sure. You know, the old adage, the key to pollution is dilution, right? So one of the things that happens when there are a couple pitfalls, I think, in detoxification, or one, there's inadequate fluid intake. The basic guideline of if you do not have kidney failure, that kind of thing, basic guideline is you take the you take your weight, divide that by 2, and that's about the number of ounces you need to drink, okay? And so that may be a little high for many people, but what you realize is that if you're a person who drinks a lot of coffee, drinks a lot of tea, that caffeine markedly increases has a diuretic effect. If you're taking medications that increase diuresis or peeing out a lot of extra fluid, then you are behind. And so if your urine is not really clear, if it's colorful, if it's looking dark, if you don't urinate very often through the day, you're most likely fluid low. And if you're fluid low, the key to pollution is dilution. You have to be able to urinate out toxins, and you will do that, and you have to have enough water to cause bulking of the fiber that you take by mouth, so that it will bind, the fiber will help bind your toxins, and you will eliminate it through your stool. And so you have to work on, if you have more fluid, you're also going to sweat better. So think about, if the first thing you do, you markedly increase your fluid intake, you're going to help your kidneys get rid of toxins. You're going to bulk up the fiber that you consume. So once the fiber bulks up, it's going to move through your bowels quicker. And then you're also going to sweat more efficiently. So that's the first thing you do. So by taking enough fluid, you're going to help all three of your normal excretory processes. Secondly, through your kidneys, is by alkalizing, by taking markedly up-ramping your vegetables and those potassium-rich foods, you are going to begin to shift the pH of your urine and saliva, and that will help you excrete more via the kidney.
What should the pH be? If you do a pH strip of urine or saliva, what should that number be?
That's a little bit controversial, but I can say that if it's the first morning urine, you want it closer to 7, 7 plus as you can get. Most people, when they urinate, if they've had a high protein dinner and they don't even take in enough fluids, their first morning urine is going to be down in the 5s to 5.6. If it's the saliva, think about the saliva, and the saliva gets a little tricky. Because if your mouth is dry and you have any conditions or medications that slow salivary flow, and thus, or you have a lot of coating on your tongue, or you take medications or your oral hygiene is off, you are going to have far more acid saliva. But it's safe to say that your saliva should be at a pH that's greater than 6.8. If your saliva is a pH greater than 6.8, then you will not be causing the enamel damage. You're more likely to have adequacy of antioxidants, so you diminish infection in your gum, in your periodontal areas. And note that saliva has components that and it's rich in calcium, rich in phosphorus, and those are buffers to help buffer the acid. So you want your pH of your saliva to be greater than 6.8.
Okay. So it's about 18 till now, and I'd like for you to talk about your your baby program, your pregnancy program.
Sure. So Grow Baby Health, growbabyhealth.com. In our practice, Leslie Stone, the other Dr. Stone in our practice, and the two nutritionists, Emily Ridbaum and Emily Wartiska, in our clinic really have a functional medicine approach to pregnancy. We were inspired to really bring this forward because we recognize through the work of some of the research through the Dutch famine studies and the China famine studies, we recognize that depending on where in pregnancy there's inadequacy of nutrients, it actually transmits to more disease in that soon-to-be child's life and in that child's offspring, meaning in that child's grandchildren. So we recognize in our practice, and between Leslie and myself, we've delivered over 6,000 babies, and Leslie still delivers 4 to 10 babies a month. We recognize that the normal prenatal labs often miss things. It often misses low zinc. It often misses low vitamin D. It often misses low carnitine. There's half the population that has trouble with their MTHFR and adequacy of making active folate. And 250% of people have trouble getting enough B12. And so we started looking at pregnancy different. And so what we did is we started having a functional medicine approach to pregnancy, where we really look at the family history. We look at the nutritional status of the mom, and so we will add those additional lab evaluations or criteria in our initial evaluation, and then we have a very structured program, nutritional program, through group visits. So they have trimester specific nutrition interventions where we use food, and then we'll use supplements as a bridge. So that's one thing. So they have the education from the nutritionists, and also we have online educational models, modules that you can go through. Then created an app. This was mainly Emily Ridbaum, who helped create this Grow Baby Mom app, which allows people to really help learn and choose and very actively help improve their nutrition through all the different trimesters. And then we also went ahead, and because these most prenatal vitamins, only half the prenatal vitamins in the United States even have iodine, and iodine deficiency is linked to autism and linked to hypothyroidism, we wanted to make sure that people could make sure to get enough probiotics, vitamin D, carnitine, zinc, and iodine. And so they put together this pregenesis pack. So in a combination, you have the education, you have the teaching of food, you have a bridge supplement, and you also have this app that helps in a constant learning. And so there are a couple apps. One app for the provider, for the physician, which will give real-time updates to whoever in their office is following the nutritional status of the mom and nutritional intake of the mom, give real-time levels of what they're doing in their diet. So what we found from this is we found that in a small study, soon to be published, we found that if we had this approach, we had less gestational diabetes, less gestational hypertension, less large for gestational age children, and less small for gestational age children, offspring. And the reason that's important is if you're large for gestational age, small for gestational age, then your chance increases for obesity, atherosclerosis, diabetes, and hypertension. If you're small for gestational age, you also have increased morbidity as you grow older as an adult, and your offspring, your baby's offspring, will have increased chronic disease. So suddenly, we had that moment where we realized, you know, if we don't get this information out there and help communicate it, we are affecting it. Multiple generations are affected. The other thing that really drove us was the skyrocketing incidence of autism. So that study out of the University of California, Davis, 2011, Journal of Epidemiology, that showed if the mom had MTHFR, SNP, and the mom also had cystathionine beta synthase SNP, and the baby had catechol-O-methyltransferase SNP, so they have trouble clearing their norepinephrine, their adrenaline. If that combination was there, and the mom did not have adequate methylation factors, adequate B vitamins, 3 months prior to conception and 1 month after conception, then there was a relative risk, 720% relative risk increase in autism. And we know autistic kids have mitochondrial issues. They have trouble and different requirements for methylation factors and the B vitamins and for protein and for the sulfation pathways. We know that is true. And so how much impact can we have if we can even just prevent one case of autism on that family unit and on that community? So that is a nutshell, and that is part of the passion of generational health that we try to bring this model to. Recognize that if we can identify the toxic issues in mom, if we can approach food recognizing it, in some people, its adverse effect, and help them change and get adequacy in nutrition, adequacy in protein, adequacy in essential fat, DHA for the baby's brain, adequacy in minimizing the carbohydrate, maximizing the fiber, simple carbohydrate, maximizing the fiber, and adequacy in the minerals, magnesium, zinc, calcium, adequacy of the B vitamins in pregnancy, and the phytonutrients, then we will impact generationally for years to come.
I have a question here about that folate. This is my own opinion, okay?
Yeah.
Many nutritional supplements today are still using folic acid. I don't particularly, from my research, think that it does any good, especially for people with the MTHFR. What kind of folate do you recommend for these mothers? Because many of them think they're getting everything they need, yet they're taking this stuff that they can't methylate. So what do you recommend to the women about this topic?
You're exactly right. It is five steps to take synthetic folate that has a stronger half-life all the way to the methylfolate. And each one of those steps requires an enzyme. And each one of those enzymes, you may have a SNP. Okay? And we know that synthetic folate actually can bind the methylfolate receptors, the folate receptors, at the blood-brain barrier, and you can get lower levels of methylfolate into the central nervous system. So you're exactly right. There's an increased problem with unmetabolized synthetic folate in the bloodstream and in tissues. So we suggest a methylfolate, no matter what your supplement is, it should have methylfolate in it, not synthetic folate.
And by methylfolate, you mean 5-MTHF, right?
We mean 5-MTHF. That's exactly right.
And I would like to just say this last thing. Distributors of food and nutrition have caught on to this thing, and many of them, I believe, have stocked up on folic acid. This is based on conversations with some of these people. They've stocked up on folic acid over the years, and so they have these huge amounts that they don't want to lose money on. So they've been changing their labels to read folate. And then if you look at the fine print down at the very bottom, it says as folic acid. So I just want to alert the consumers to read your labels, because even if it says folate, it's probably folic acid. It's got to say 5-MTHF. At least that's my experience.
Sure. And you know, when you take plant-based folates, right, 85 to 90% of the folate in our bloodstream, if you don't take a synthetic folate, is going to be a methylfolate. And then about 10% is going to be tetrahydrofolate. There are at least 8 to 10, depending on who you read, different folate combinations in the greens. And so you can go a long way by markedly increasing the greens in your diet, okay? Not overcooking them, juicing them, eating them just steamed. You can do a lot to improve your folate level. And, you know, the safe level, well-documented, without knowing your MTHFR status or anything, is really a milligram. And then depending on people's MTHFR status and what SNPs they have and their other issues, we'll go up higher in pregnancy, especially if there's been previous pregnancy loss or there have been different neural tube defects or that kind of thing. But it's just important to note that, as with anything, it's not just a single nutrient. You have to look at the waterfront of B vitamins, because they all help work together to form the normal metabolism that allows you to harvest energy from the foods you eat and make your health on a positive trajectory versus a negative one.
And we've only got about 3 or 4 minutes, but I feel compelled to ask you about this. For people who have not been taking active folate, who get pregnant or otherwise have some health issues and suddenly start taking it, do you have any words of advice about the detoxification? And we've only got 3 or 4 minutes.
Sure. My only comment is, if you've been taking a milligram of folate as a prenatal vitamin, you can usually go to the same amount in the prenatal vitamin. If you notice that for any reason you have any sleep changes or there's increased any increased anxiety or that kind of thing, then you start looking at not necessarily the folate, but you start looking at, do you have some of the other genetic SNPs that don't allow you to clear the adrenaline. So
or
most
the,
days, go ahead.
I just want to say the one where you have if I take too much folate, it puts me on the bed and it takes me five. If I get mixed up and take more than one a day, I will be on the bed for 5 days.
Yeah.
So I don't want people to be shocked about that.
Yeah, my comment is start low. You know, if you're at 400 micrograms in a normal pregnancy, then take 400 micrograms of methylfolate, and you can do that very easily. and people do well. But you have to think about your other B vitamins as well. Adequacy of B12, adequacy of pyridoxine triphosphate, adequacy of thiamine, riboflavin, niacin, because all of those really help your mitochondria and your detox pathways work.
Now, is there an importance about taking a particular form of B12 or not?
Well, that's a good question.
Does it need to be methyl B12?
It can be methyl or it can be hydroxy B12. You can take a sublingual B12. And, you know, once again, it's that conversion issue, how your body converts it to its most active form.
But I guess what I'm asking, I want them to know is the preference would not be regular cobalamin.
Correct.
Is that right?
About 1 minute.
I'm not a doctor, so I have to get you to say that.
No, that is correct. And so I can tell you that we have the active form B12 methylcobalamin in the things that we use.
And do you have a line of supplements? Do you sell supplements? Do people want to order some? Do you do that?
We do. You know, we have a smattering of different vendors that we use. If you're interested at all in the prenatal supplement, you can look at it on growbabyhealth.com, and you can choose for yourself. There's plenty of information there, or you can cobble together your own combination. But we have all the references on why we think this is very important for most healthy pregnancy.
And the app that you have, is there a cost to the app? And we've got 30 seconds.
If you go to the site, if the Grow Baby Pro is for the professional, there is a cost because that's active, and then Grow Baby Mom does not have any cost to it.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stone. Please tell us one more time your website.
Yeah, growbabyhealth.com or ashlandmd.com.
Thank you. You're fabulous, and I appreciate you taking the time for us tonight.
Absolutely.
Good night.
Thank you very much.